announce it in kindergarten. Well, you can't see. I'm wearing foundation. I have a little. It's not huge, so it's a long time ago.
Okay, so let's get going. Yes. So hopefully you found the webpage. New people might have joined in. Some people just signed up, maybe new victims. Other people probably left. Okay, so what we're going to do is to try to finish up some things today, but take a note of what's going on over here. Let me see if I can get this thing functioning again here. There we go. I think for some reason that music's playing in the background. As we see what's going on over here at 9:25, this Wade 2:31. This is thematic today. Okay, we're going to talk about this somehow. You'll see how it all connects. Some of you might have made the connection already, hopefully. Okay. All right, so the web page is here, and you've probably found some neat little things to listen to. And if you scroll on down, remember, PowerPoints are also here. You can click there, and they go down to PowerPoints, but it's also on Canvas. And on Canvas, you also have, what on earth is this thing? You also have your Echo 360 on that link that you can click on and download that. It starts at this time and ends right on time. And all the PowerPoints are up there. Okay, so any questions so far about course content or how we're going about this class? Stress? You figured it all out, right? Just study all the time. You're just going to be physiologists the whole semester long. Okay, great. And this is supposed to induce stress. I'm supposed to get your heart rates going just by shaking your names, right? No, let's do this. Okay, we'll figure that out as we go along. So let's find the first victim for the day and ask a question. Sarah Thacker. Sarah.
Yes.
What interests you in science recently? What's some interesting findings that have come out?
I kind of thought it was interesting that I've not been in China, but I have genetically and I used to so that they were still in China.
Yes, everybody follow that? About the doctor in China that genetically engineered the baby for resistance of HIV, right? Kind of keep up with science, keep up with what's going on in the world, especially this one for allied health people. It caused a lot of debate. Do you kind of remember what happened with the community, the scientific community with this? Does anybody remember, or did you follow it up?
Yeah, he's on cancer in China, and he's not faced with
it. Supposedly he didn't get the approval from even the university he was working at to do this kind of work, right? And so he kind of did it under the table, kind of thing to do. That's why you have review committees for doing things. So I guess some of the controversy, too, had to be there's other ways to treat for HIV, and you didn't have to genetically modify someone for the next generations to go, right? That's kind of it. So keep up with stuff. Anybody subscribe to Science Daily? Science Daily? Oh, my goodness. I will send you an email link where you can sign up. I'd just love to put your name in there for everybody on their email, but I won't do that to you. But you can sign up to Science Daily. I'll give you the link, and you can click to which articles that you're interested in, hearing about. So that way, when you're in bed, and you check your phone to find out if you're waking up too late or not, or the alarm goes off, you can hit your email, and then it'll pop up every day with science discoveries that were basically published yesterday. And it's kind of neat. So it gets you going before your, lethargic legs hit the ground, and you can say, hey, that's really cool. I can't wait to get to classes to learn more about this stuff. Right, and then usually on the bottom of those little synopsis is the primary article link that you can then link to. And so you can look at space exploration or just human health, for example, or legislation with human health, health care, for example. It's really neat. It keeps you up to the current information that's going on. Let's say some of you are interviewing for med school, maybe, or dental school. And we've had this kind of situation, so I just plant this in your mind right now. So this faculty member over at EOBEL kind of frauds me every once in a while, and I fraud him. He said, oh, we just interviewed this kid from UK for med school, And, you know, we asked him this simple question about what's the difference with the Affordable Care Act? What's the debate all about? And he said, I don't really know. And the question was, and you want to go into healthcare? The interview was basically over for this kid, right? His passion for going into medicine, and he had no idea about the healthcare, you know, situation that he's going to go and spend his career on. So I'm kind of giving you a word of advice. Understand what your profession that you want to go into is about and the debates going on in there. And so those are good things to pay attention to as well. But also, sometimes on other interviews, they ask him, what's your favorite breakthrough in science that, you know, that you've studied in undergraduate? You spent 4 years as an undergraduate. What really interested you the most in your scientific career that you've had, you know, biology or chemistry major? The students are, no, I've craved all this information, but did you have any passion for anything? Anything that really excited you? So kind of get ready for those kind of questions, right? Because you don't want to be the deer in the headlights on those kind of interviews because you've worked so hard to get to that point. And then in those 15 minutes, you kind of blew it, right? Not a good thing to do. Also, we've had some gouging about purpose statements from students applying to these professional programs, and the purpose statement being a disaster. Like not really synchronized well, not logical thought, why you want to do this or that. And definitely get people to read over your purpose statements if you're applying to these programs and have somebody else look over it. Maybe someone that's not in the health profession, just to make sure they understand why you're interested in the field you're interested in, right? So those are good things to help, hopefully help you. Okay, so where are we today? We're talking about cells, right? And metabolism. And the biochemistry that we've promised you that you're going to go back through. But I don't want you to try to memorize every detail in these biochemical reactions because that's a bit, that's what you're going to cover in biochemistry. But the main concepts, all right, which are really quite cool. And it relates to the labs you're doing this week. Who had lab on Monday already? Yep. And did it go okay? Yep. And you got some data? Yes, maybe. The numbers? Did the, what was the outcome of your lab, basically? What kind of happened, just generally? So the crayfish in the room temperature use more oxygen than the crayfish in the chilled water, right? And you might, did you predict that maybe? And I know that might be a question, but that's kind of common sense for your quiz. Everybody does those quizzes before lab, right? You know, some of those aren't so bad, right, generally. So why might you think that there's a difference in metabolism in an animal chilled versus the animal at room temperature? A different, less metabolism than one at room temperature. If you went into the cold, like today's cold day, right, and you went outside without your jacket, is your metabolism going to go up or down?
Slow down.
Slow down? Speed up? Stay the same? I don't care. Go up? Go up. Why is it going to go up, Jim?
We're regulating our body temperature.
Exactly. We're regulating our body temperature. So the other animals might be, what's the key word we're looking for? Ectotherms, but also, what did we kind of cover on the PowerPoint? Conformers to the environment. But we did talk about behavioral changes, right? So maybe they will behaviorally alter their body temperature by, you know, choosing a warmer environment if they have the choice. Those little crayfish in that glass container really don't have much of a choice this week, right? They have to stay in there. But it's potentially, it could go up if they're trying to find a warmer place and maybe look around, right? Trying to escape or something. So you could think about various aspects with this. Now, as we get along in the course and you have to start doing some write-ups for lab, we're going to talk about those GCCRs and kind of make sure that we're all on the same page and that you're really looking up information, and we can discuss some of that in class as well because I want you to do well in those GCCRs. I can't emphasize enough, usually the lab brings down people's grades, right? So let's keep that up high, and then you don't have to stress out about that, right? It's that writing assignment, and they'll probably grade pretty hard on this first assignment to get you ready for the later assignments, right? So we want you to really hit it hard. They don't have as many points on these first assignments to get you ready for the later assignments, but you don't want a low grade to start with. You want to aim it up high to begin with, so overkill, right? on this first assignment. Make sure you follow all the instructions, because they kind of have this rubric to look at those instructions, and that's how the points get taken off, right? So follow the rubric, follow exactly what is required on the writing assignment. All right? Okay, good deal. Is this thing working? I'm worried about this music in the background still playing, and maybe echoes not, but we'll see what happens. Okay, so we started to talk about the cell, and how important is the cell? Does it drive, you know, if we just have some cells in our muscle, right? You know, muscle cells, skeletal muscle cells, and you exercise your leg, does it have any impact on the rest of your body, do you think? The other systems of your body? How might it impact another system in your body? Where's this victim list? Okay, here we go. All right, more stress. This has an impact on your body already, I'm sure. Mark Castro. Yes.
Maybe that cell, because it was working so much, it's used a lot of the energy sources the body has. So mm-hmm. that's involved in other areas of the body. And sort of the sources to repair itself.
Good idea. So that's right on. And let's see, so energy sources like glucose, right, being utilized. So how is it going to impact the other part of the body, say another part? Let's just think of mechanisms. So here we have the cell utilizing up the glucose stores drop. What's going to happen? How does it signal in the other part of the body?
It would probably be something with the endocrine system where it can travel from the bloodstream to the organ systems, where the organ systems don't necessarily have to be directly surrounding the muscles to be exercised.
Good point. So maybe that glucose is being utilized, drops in the blood because it's being pulled in that exercising muscle, for example, right, through insulin actions. And we'll talk more about it later, you know, just getting that more of the details. And so if blood glucose drops, then other cells in your body detect that, right? And like you said, the endocrine response is, oh, we got to jack the glucose back up. Maybe we got to work on the liver and break down some glycogen and get the glucose in the blood so it can be utilized in the muscle, right? So that's at tissue level of the skeletal muscle affecting the rest of your body. But I want you to make all these connections, right? And then how it might influence the heart or the brain. If glucose drops, right? Can't be thinking. Pass out. So think about these things at an aspect. And let's think about some relationship here. And we have a activity that we're going to do. Start it off, get you going, get the brain juices flowing. And we will pick some victims. Let's pick some victims at random so I don't just pick them.
Something.
Oh, my goodness. We don't want to lose your name. We would have a disaster. How about you pick a name out of here?
Sure.
Call your favorite enemy. Gabriel Brown. Are we here? Yes. Okay, we've got another one. How about another one? Maybe four. Taylor Decker. Yay. All right. And Justin Bergman.
One more.
Oh, one more. And Sarah Thatcher. Yeah, Sarah. Okay. All right. Thank you. I guess I'll have to take him out of there and think about it. So let's see. Where are these victims? There's Sarah. It doesn't hurt too bad, I promise. You were down there? You were over there? Okay. And the other victim was over here somewhere?
Where was that other victim?
Oh, there we are. Okay. So, what are we going to do? Have you seen these things before? Probably. If you work in a healthcare field, for example, or you're a CNA, put those on your finger, like that, and you can read the values that are on there. You push this little button, okay? Then you relax. If you have too much fingernail polish, it might not work, but they usually work. And it's going to read your heart rate, and it's going to read something else. Your oxygen saturation, okay? So, and then push the little button. Did everybody do that? Just push your buttons. Let's see what your percent saturation of oxygen is. What's yours? 90. 93. Okay. How about yours over there? Put it on your finger. What's yours?
It's just a bar going up and down.
Oh, it's going to do it in a minute.
More time.
98, that's better. Where's the other victim? What's your 99? You got from.
How about your turn to read?
I think it's 72, but
Hey, try your pinky finger instead.
96 now, she's back to life. Alright. So this is what they use in clinics, for example, and some people put it on their finger themselves to kind of see where their heart rate is, for example, or the percent saturation of oxygen. So keep it on your finger, and I'm worried about you. We're going to watch you defend your sitting desk. Okay, how about you? Is it reading now?
It's at 80.
Are we reading the heart rate or the... Okay, one second.
It could be a little bad reading.
I'm not reading. It's
okay. Or something?
98 now.
No, 98. Okay, we're getting there. So now what you're going to... And you're still 90-something?
Yeah.
Okay, so these victims, it's four victims. We're going to watch them to make sure they don't pass out. But you're going to take a deep breath and hold it. And right when you have to breathe, look at the numbers and see what the numbers are. Okay? We can time them to see how good they are for holding their breath. Can we go for 5 minutes? So right when you have to breathe, don't breathe through your nose. I'm cheap. Suspense, I know. Okay. And you might think this is corny, but there's a good learning lesson behind this, okay? And when they start turning blue in the lips and their heads fall. Okay, he stopped. All right. What was your number?
Said 67, but now it says 139.
That is great. All right, so there's this issue with that thing happening. She's still holding her breath. Still said 100? Okay. So I think that means the fact that not you, but alright. So and you said 100. Oh my gosh. Alright. So what's going on here? I'll have to get that one shut. Is it still breathing? 98. You can try holding your breath again and see if it changes. So, 100, 98, still hanging up high. What on earth is going on here? So this is your percent saturation of oxygen in your hemoglobin. That's what it's measuring. Percent saturation of your hemoglobin, and the hemoglobin goes through your finger, and it's measuring the oxygen saturation on your hemoglobin. So it's percent saturation of oxygen on your hemoglobin. And basically, it didn't go down when you had to breathe, right? But what happens when you're late or you're running up and down the steps and you sit down and your breathing rate, respiratory rate is still high? Why is it still high? When you had to breathe, was your oxygen saturation lower? Not really, right? Not except for this gentleman. Is it working now?
I think so. It's just 98.
Okay, and you held your breath and it was still 98? All right, so... Take home. What's the take home of this exercise?
We use valuable class time for.
Take home is generally you've probably been told that you have an oxygen debt when you exercise, right? And that when you stop, you have to breathe more. And that's why you're still breathing at a higher rate after you stop exercising. Do you remember oxygen debt from high school? No? Yes? Maybe? Don't remember? 3 years ago? 4 years ago? Was it really oxygen debt if your numbers stayed the same, percent saturation? So what caused you to increase your respiratory rate? I mean, what caused you to want to really breathe after you're holding your breath if the oxygen didn't go down? We're going to get a victim. Let's get a victim. We got to get a victim. Art, this gentleman raised his hand in the very back, which I haven't victimized yet, but still.
Breathing.
Yes, very good. CO2. And hopefully this is fitting with what we're doing over here, right? This is dry ice over here on this balance. Look at 925. It was 231. What is it now? 186, right? CO2 is leaving, right? So it's the CO2, but how is it that CO2 is driving your wanting to breathe? Well, we've got a question back here. So the point is, if you have too much CO2 in your blood, it's going to relate to acidosis, right? How does it relate to acidosis?
CO2 is a more acidic molecule than oxygen, so it raises the, or lowers the pH of your blood.
So CO2 is, will lower the pH of your blood because of, let's think about, related to last week's chit-chat we had about a bet, you know, we were talking about with the nerve terminal, but there was another bet about chemical reactions. What's another chemical reaction that's super fast in your body, most every cell in your body? It's a million-fold faster because of a particular enzyme. Remember? Yes? Well, that's the one I lost the bet on, $100. That's just a chemical reaction. But the other one that relates to CO2. Exactly. So carbonic anhydrase, CA, abbreviated in many textbooks, but you're right. So CO2 plus water, you know, little arrows, like you remember in chemistry, an arrow. So H2, CO3, and then another arrow. H plus bicarb, HCO3 minus, right? So CO2 plus water breaks down are reactions to hydrogen ions plus bicarb, right? That hydrogen ion in your blood is your pH, right? So if you raise the hydrogen ion concentration, what happens to your pH?
Yeah.
Trick question. Remember, it goes down, right? Don't get confused about that. All right, so the CO2 basically was building up in your body because you're not breathing. And she got that right about breathing, right? So if you're not breathing, the CO2 is building up. What's happening to your pH in your blood? It's dropping. And then that's causing you to really breathe, right? So it's not the oxygen debt. Take home this long exercise is it's not the oxygen debt. It's the pH change in your blood. You're very sensitive to pH, all right? So that's what's really driving. Now, mechanistically, how is that working? Mechanistically. That's what we're covering, function, physiology. Mechanistically, how does that work? Let's say blood pH drops. So what? You know, where is it? How is it causing you to want to breathe? Well, behaviorally, right? It's got to be related to your kidneys. No, I'm joking. To your brain, right? So yeah. Somehow there are sensory receptors that can sense that pH drop. Where are those sensory receptors? Well, I know we're going to cover that. That's why you're in this class, right? But there are these receptors in your body, and people get these confused on standardized exams, so let's try to, I'm going to reinforce these things over and over again to make sure that you remember this when you're taking these kind of standardized exams, too. They usually have some kind of question related with this. What measures your blood pressure in your body? Like when you get up out of bed, you don't pass out. Or if you got it too fast, sometimes you think you're late to class and you just can't wait to get to class, right? So you just jump up out of bed and you're running all through, you black out.
Baroreceptors.
Baroreceptors. Where are those baroreceptors?
It's in your aorta or something, right?
Yeah, something with the circulatory system. You got that, because it has to measure this. That's right. Right on. And you might, we're going to cover it, so don't feel bad if you don't know it. Carotid. The two things that they get confused all the time, carotid bodies and carotid sinuses. Oh, which one is it? Carotid sinuses, carotid bodies. How do I remember this? What happens when you have a sinus headache? Do you feel pressure? Sinus headache, right? Sinus headache, pressure, carotid sinuses. Blood pressure. Now you'll never forget that. When you get that on your standardized exam, you got that answer right. You're going to get accepted to whatever you're applying to. All right. So carotid sinuses, blood pressure, carotid bodies, pH, and aortic bodies, pH, all right? But you also have receptors in your brain part that we'll talk about later that can detect some of these changes as well. But the main ones, carotid sinuses, blood pressure, carotid bodies, pH. But now, mechanistically, how does that happen? CO2 building up in your blood, it's kind of converted to bicarb, pH drops. Does the hydrogen ion just go across the bilipid membrane and get into that cell? And that changes something in these carotid bodies that you're talking about? Well, think about CO2 can go across the bilipid membranes. We're going to talk about membranes. It's a gas. It can go right through the bilipid membranes. You know, like gamma rays right through you, right? So it can, CO2 can go right through the bilipid membranes and get into the cell. And what's inside the cell? Fastest enzyme, one of the fastest enzymes. Carbonic anhydrase, a millionfold faster. Hydrogen ion plus bicarb. Hydrogen ion, pH drops, cell. Maybe it detects the pH. Maybe it detects the bicarb. But anyways, it's going to change the firing rate of the carotid bodies, and that firing rate goes to your brain and says, you got to breathe, right? You have a drive to breathe. And so that's how that works mechanistically. Now, in that cell of the carotid bodies and some parts in your brain, do you know they're still trying to figure out exactly what causes the increased firing rate of that neuron? There's a guy that just passed away last year who was up at Wright State up in Dayton, Ohio, Putman. He was a world expert on this, and he actually studied turtles and how turtles could become very hypoxic and, you know, hold their breath for a long time. And he was studying how those cells fire and relating it to mammalian systems. Because you probably heard of SIDS. What's SIDS?
Sudden infant death syndrome.
Sudden infant death syndrome. There's a relationship that people are working with that maybe they're not as sensitive enough to the pH at a young age, or maybe the CO2 is too high or the pH has dropped. It usually happens around when the baby's too warm, for one thing, too. So there's a lot of this input, but they're trying to figure out exactly what kicks in with the SIDS, for example. But by studying it on a comparative aspect, they're trying to figure out how those neurons actually detect pH. Something so important for all humans, right? pH regulation. And think about, we're still kind of debating how those cells respond to it. Because as soon as you change the pH in the cell, you also change the bicarb, right? So it's kind of like that Heisenberg uncertainty principle you all heard, you know, like figuring the electron spin and the position at the same time. It's the same problem with many physiological concepts. You start to measure something, you're manipulating something else. Are you, you know, changing another variable, right? Are we all together? Kind of. We're going to definitely get caffeine up before class. All right. So where are we now with this? 177. So, okay. So now we relate pH, CO2, right? We're going to cover that over and over again. We'll talk about that tattoo that you need to get. It's very important. All right. My goodness. How much CO2 do we breathe out a day? Are we contributing to the CO2 rise in the atmosphere? Got to get rid of humans, right? No. So how much CO2 do you breathe a day? How much CO2 are you breathing out a day? Are we contributing to global CO2 rise in the atmosphere? What do you think? You think anybody's ever worried about that? They actually have. And when people measure CO2, environmental chemists, for example, they actually make sure they're not breathing around the instruments, because some of those instruments are so sensitive, they'll pick up the CO2 even if they took their dog out for a walk and they're setting up their division, you know, their setups. They actually like make sure their dog stays in the car or they're away from when they're doing their measurements, so they try not to walk around it. And there's all these balloons up in the atmosphere and lots of different measures all around the world to measure CO2 levels. And they know where people are. CO2 levels change, like when they're active and things. But do you think it's adding to the global CO2? Just think about that for a minute. Maybe talk with your friends. Think about it. Or just have a chill moment. Where does the CO2 come from? Chill. Think of what you learned in high school. Carbon cycle. Carbon cycle. Remember carbon cycle? Maybe. It's all that stuff we purged. Right? Any ideas? What are you thinking? And you are welcome to use laptops and surfaces and your iPhones in this class to look up information. So, what did we come up with? Anybody want to share out? Yes. To you and to be eating. So, right on. So, we really are contributing to rising CO2 levels, right? But you can figure out how much that might be. And if you go to websites, which are really kind of cool, you can just type in, you know, CO2 produced by humans. And this person, on average, came up with about, what, 700 grams of carbon dioxide a day. That's pretty cool. 700 grams of carbon dioxide a day. So, you know, search things out on the line. I'm trying to get you to think about things. Interesting things in physiology. Just search it out. Like you have a question. Oh, let me type that in. Figure out if Wikipedia is right or wrong, right? Because you can go to the sources at the bottom of the pages or maybe find some primary articles, right? PubMed.gov, right? PubMed.gov. If it's not shut down, it might be shut down these days. But usually you can get some, then some primary literature, right? And more debate going on about transportation and increasing CO2. So pretty neat to think about, all right? So I want you to, you know, investigate things. And Science Daily is a great source as well. All right, so I got to quit going too crazy. Now let's think about where this is now. 171 versus 231. The straw ice is going away, right? Okay, let's just make sure that we understand this. And we're going to go quickly through metabolism. Let's say you had breakfast this morning. Right. Hopefully, some of you had breakfast. It's important to get the glucose levels up. Mainly, just have caffeine. That's my thing. That's my way. A cup of coffee, and I'm hyper enough for class. All right. And you're ordering what? Start decaf, right? All right. So, what happened if you ate food today, this morning, and you were so busy in classes you didn't even have time to use the restroom? All right. So, you didn't use the restroom today, you didn't eat, you didn't poop. And at the end of the day, it's 5 o'clock, and finally, yeah, I can go to the bathroom, right? And relieve myself or whatever. But you used energy throughout the day. Did you lose weight throughout the day? Maybe. What happened? What do you think? Some people wish they did. I tried. I did. It doesn't happen. I eat too much at the end of it. Thoughts? Where are we going with this? Connection? Are we making connection? Right? What does CO2? CO2, how many grams did we say we exhale a day? Right? It's a byproduct. Are we putting anything into the system? So systems is a really good way to think about things. I don't mean systems like cardiovascular, renal, and all that. I mean a system, like a closed system. You can try to think about that like chemistry. And systems is a really good way to think about things. If you go into allied health, they'll actually think about systems as modeling systems. Like the efficiency of an ER room, for example, is actually modeled in a system model, like input, output, how fast it works, efficiency, or even of a clinic or anything like that. Industry uses it, businesses uses it, physiologists use it. All right, so think of a system, your system. You didn't add any food to it. You might be breathing in air. What's in air? Oxygen, right? CO2 maybe a little bit, right? Nitrogen, right? And then you're exhaling, and you lost 170 grams of CO2. So do you think your body weight went up? Yes, no. How many think your body weight went down? How many think your body weight increased throughout the day? How many don't care? All right, so I know. Caffeine, all right, that's the key. Keep going. So likely you've lost some weight, right, throughout the day. So just starve yourself the next 3 days, and you'll have your diet that you like. All right? No, don't do that. I want you to stay there. So the CO2, you're losing that in your body weight. So where does your weight go when you're on a diet? It's not just peeing it out in water or pooping it out in food, right? You're not just breaking down the muscle and it's excreting out your body, but you're breathing it out. So really losing weight, what are you losing? What's the metabolism? What's the breakdown? CO2. Isn't that amazing? Your weight loss, your diet, you never hear that on TV, right? They just need to put CO2 out there, right? And it's like you're losing it. And that really kind of confuses me that some of these hot yoga places, you hear them advertising that you're exercising in a hot yoga. And we just talked about metabolism in the cold. So there's all these things that are connecting. This isn't just random information, it's connecting. So a mammal, a homeotherm, was to exercise, would you lose more weight, do you think, probably exercising in a cold room than you might in a hot room? You know, these hot yogas, anybody ever do that kind of craziness? Right? I got my wife one of those stickers, the things like a gift card thing for my daughter. Well, I didn't realize that was not a thing to gift to your wife, you know, like exercising. No, that was not a good idea. But my daughter saved me, and she kind of convinced this is just good to try. But anyways, they weren't prepared for this thing, and they went in like full clothes, and everybody else is in like shorts or something. Anyways, they tried it. I got in trouble by the end of the day. But anyways, so it's probably better to start a cold yoga place, right? And you could probably compete with the hot yoga people and say you're going to lose more weight in my place than you will in their place, and you're going to make money and give a percentage to me because we figured out how you can make money. All right. So think about these. This is really kind of interesting, right? You could probably lose more weight by exercising in the cold and keeping it really cold because you're trying to keep metabolism up to keep your body temperature, right? So go out and exercise without your jackets today, right? Okay. All right, so we're making sense about the CO2, and it does weight. Last year, we actually had somebody in the class that said CO2 doesn't have any weight. Okay, so this is why I have this demo this year, right? After 23 years, I never thought I would hear that. But anyways, so CO2 does have weight. You do lose it by breathing. And dry ice is going off. What is it doing? What's the word we're looking for in chemistry? Sublimation. Is this sublimation? Is that what this is? Yes, maybe. Okay. And try to describe that. If you had to write that down, and we're thinking of how would you describe a scientific observation? And you don't know about sublimation. You didn't memorize that in chemistry. You just saw the reaction like this. Like ice melting, right? What would you write? I mean, just try to think about what you would write down. Your observation. Ice, this ice cube, you know, it's winter. You saw an icicle. The sun warms it up and it turns into water. And then all of a sudden that water's on the ground. And then it just disappeared. I know this might sound elementary and silly. But how would you write that down? If you don't have the facts to think, if you were the first person to try to describe this, right? What would you really do? Where did it go? Magic. I had ice, it was solid, I felt it, and now it's like I don't have anything in my hand. What happened to it? Aliens took it. I don't know. Right? Isn't that kind of interesting? Think about the scientific people before you that had to write observations of scientific observations that they saw. think about what we're writing today, what we see or what we measure, and think about people in the future thinking what we're writing today, they might think, you're crazy, you know? We now know all this other information, right? Back then, they actually thought it was some kind of spirits, you know, at one time, right? So it's really kind of interesting to think about the scientific process and where we came. People used to think that when you exercised your muscle and you made a muscle, right? Some of you bigger biceps than me. And when you make a bicep and that muscle would it enlarge, they thought it filled up with air. Isn't that wild? But people actually believed it and they accepted it. It was written down because if you stop somebody from breathing, they couldn't contract their arm, right? Couldn't do much of anything. So they thought it had to do with the air, and the air filled up your arm. But then when some people did experiments like putting it in a chamber and having you contract your arm muscle, the volume didn't change. So they thought, oh, then it can't be filling up with air. So the point was experimentation, instead of just guessing about things, doing experiments that others can replicate is the importance of science. And it's the importance of physiology as well. So some of the things that you hear about, like what we just did, oxygen debt, in textbooks it's still there. It's horrible, right? Because we know it's not oxygen debt. But why is it still in the textbook? It takes a long time to change the writing and the science. Okay, so we're done with that exercise. There was something else, tangent, that was going on. Oh, pH, just to make sure about pH. pH, wild, isn't it? pH, 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 pH. And it's related to what we talked about last Thursday. We have water. Let's take this virtual beaker of water. Let's put a pH probe in there. And it's distilled water. What's the pH? What are we thinking about? We just take pure water. We're going to measure the pH. 7, okay. Now we're going to take that, we're going to have 3 replicates, 3 different beakers. We're going to take this beaker on over here, we're going to warm this beaker up, we're going to take this beaker over here, we're going to cool this one down, and this one's going to be at room temperature. And we're going to measure with the same pH probe. Is the pH different in any one of these 3? Let's think about that. Is the pH any different in any of those? What's the pH equation that we remember from high school or freshman biology or freshman chemistry? Right? pH equals negative log of the hydrogen ion concentration. Is that right? Does that ring a bell? pH equals negative log of hydrogen ion. So where's temperature in there? Where's temperature? Now let's think about, is the pH any different in any of those water? In those 3 water? What do you think? How many think it's going to be the same? How many think it doesn't change? And again, the rest, I don't care. Okay, all right. So where is the temperature in that equation? Because that's the equation that you were given, right? And remember that thing about learning the valves and learning what you had to, the exercise we went through? You're not given enough information. That pH equation isn't the full equation. It's the pH equals the negative log of the hydrogen ion concentration times the activity coefficient of whatever that substance is. And inside that activity coefficient, there's a temperature factor. So we never really learned how to measure pH correctly, did we? Alright. So pH will change with temperature. What happens if you heat up water? What does it do? It turns to steam, right? But what's water? Water, H2O, to then turn into the gases that go away. What do we have? Hydrogen, oxygen, right? But H compared up to OH, H plus. As you heat water, you start to break it down, and you have more hydrogen ions. So the hotter the water, the lower the pH. Cooler the water, up the pH, more basic. So pH in water changes with temperature. Now, how does that relate to this class? Let's find the victim. The victim. And if I already called your name or victimized you today, we can get somebody else. Jonathan Brazilia. Brazilla.
Brazilia.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. How does the pH that we're talking about, you know, now with temperature, how does that relate to compared to physiology class, do you think?
Well, different parts of the body are going to thrive best in different environments, and that includes pH. So there's certain parts where you're going to want a little bit more acid and where you're going to want a little bit more base.
Okay. Good. maybe on a comparative aspect with different animals, another victim too, the good. That, but that's right, because in your own body, you might have different regions. Brandon Hamill? Brandon, all right. How about any ideas? Think about comparative, lots of animals. Some that we talked about very early on today, maybe. pH, how does pH relate with this class, in a sense, with comparative physiology besides just your own body? It's an important concept. You'll see this on an exam, hint, hint. With temperature?
Well, if pH can change with temperature, then regulating temperature would also affect regulating pH.
Yes, regulating temperature can affect pH. How about the animal that's a conformer? Right? You take that little lizard, and it's out on the desert day. He walks out from his little hole, and now he's heating up his body. Temperature is rising, right? Because it wants to warm up. What else is changing? pH, right? What about the animal that has a diving response, like the iguana in the Galapagos or something, right? It's out in the hot temperature, and now it's diving in the cool water. And it's a conformer, right? But it's swimming, so the metabolism might try to keep it up a little bit, but it's getting colder. So what's happening to pH? It's got to regulate the pH with the temperature that it's conforming with, too. So do they maybe have better ability to regulate pH than a homeotherm, potentially? Wouldn't that be an interesting question? I don't know the answer. But it's probably out there. Somebody's probably studied it. There's actually a journal called Comparative Biochemistry. Doesn't that sound like fun? Comparative Biochemistry, where they actually study biochemical reactions on comparative aspects. Okay, so hopefully we've learned a few things about this. And pH changes in water with temperature. Okay, and you can ask, if you're still taking chemistry, ask your TAs. We had, when I taught freshman biology, I asked them to go ask their TAs, and they came back and said, my TA said it doesn't change. So it was a real problem. So the thing is, I don't know what they're, you know, if they get through those problems of the real reactions. So it is an issue. All right, so how about pH range? What's the pH range that we have out in the real world? What do we all know about pH? What does it range from? 1 to 14. Anybody else have ideas? Does it go 113, 0.25? What's the range of pH out in the world? Anybody studying environmental sciences here? Environmentalists? pH range. We all memorized exactly this, right? 1 to 14. Why do we think that? Why is it stuck in our brain? Because our high school science teacher told us. No. Because we measured in freshman chemistry. Is that
just water?
Is that just water? That's a good point. But the water changes the temperature, right? So, guess what? pH equals negative hydrogen ion concentration times the activity coefficient. Let's forget the activity coefficient for now. Let's just think about it. Remember standard thermometric temperature and pressure, right? All that ST stuff here. Remember for chemistry, at zero atmospheric pressure and so much temperature, zero Kelvin or whatever it is, right? Or zero, what is it that we have to remember for chemistry? Wasn't it that? 273 minus 273. Okay, so think about all that. So we're not going to worry about the temperature. And we're going to measure this pH of this solution. So let's think about pH equals the negative log of hydrogen ion concentration. Let's put hydrogen at 10. What's the log of 10? Anybody remember this? 1, right? Castor got it, 1. But we said pH equals negative log of 10, so pH equals a negative 1. If you had a 10 molar strong acid, you just got a negative 1. But the pH we were just talking about was 114, right? It's because the way that you measure the pH meter that was created by Beckman only measures between 1 and 14. So you're limited by the instrument you're using, right? pH in the natural environment can go down to, well, not really natural, but it can go down to negative values. We just did it. 10 molar strong acid will be a negative 1. You have streams out in California where they're using mining with strong acids like chromic acid and others to get out silver and gold and all that stuff, and it washes down into the stream, and people have measured that stream in the ponds, negative 2 pH. Negative 2 pH. Wow, what kind of life to live in negative 2 pH? Well, guess what? They found bacteria that was living in that. And so the microbiologists, whew, all excited, they went out and figured out what that bacteria was. And this is a number of years ago, but they found out new strains of bacteria they never had identified before. Kind of cool, right? Can you get a pH greater than 14? You can't. But you're limited to that measurement device. So the point is, scientific measurements, I know I'm dragging on about science in general, but it's so important to think about your measurement device and how accurate it is. Errors in science always happen. You're going to have it in your lab reports too, and sometimes the TAs don't catch it, and I try to convince them about it. Let's do you're taking measurements. Let's say you're taking measurements with a yardstick that has inches and no subdivisions between an inch, right? So you got your 36 inches, and you're measuring different things, all right? So you get 1 times 36, 1 times 24, 1 times 12, 1 times 15, 1 times 20, 1 times 15, you know, something. You add them all up, and you want to find out the average value, right? And then you're going to measure another population of things with something else, and you're going to compare these two different distributions. So you add them up and divide by how many times you measured it, right? Different things, like say 10. And you come up with 12.523. What's the problem here? What's the problem? Could you measure that? That's right. There's too many significant figures. So watch out on your lab reports, too, right? If you just add these numbers together, your significant figure for your measurement shouldn't be any better than the instrument that you use to measure. So you'd have to round that off to inches. Right? It's not just a numerical value. This is a common mistake. You see it even in scientific literature, but don't make the mistake on your lab reports. All right? So think about that. And when you start to look at that, you find out there's a real issue. Statistics is important in science. We're going to talk a little bit. I'm yakking too much about other things. But statistics. A number of years back, there was a textbook that was just great, Biostatistics. Introductory chapter. Went through and compared cardiovascular research in the U.S., everything funded by NIH and cardiovascular research. They went back and investigated hundreds of articles, hundreds of scientific studies with different drugs that are used in people to find out if it was really significant. And they found out almost 90% of the articles scientists used had wrong statistics. Using statistics in the wrong way. NIH went ballistic. And that's why now they want a statistician involved in science and studies if you're getting NIH money. Because a lot of studies had to backtrack and find out, was that now really significant or not, right? And so there's real interest in trying to figure out, you know, doing the right stats. It's really important to understand the stats. And if you're in the healthcare field and you're reading papers, maybe the older ones you got to kind of watch out for. The newer ones are probably a little bit better on it because there's usually a whole division in the scientific paper now, statistical analysis, right, and how it was done, usually required. So it's really quite neat to think about these issues. Okay, let's quit yakking. All right, so we've talked about the cell. We're seeing the CO2. Where are we now? 151. My God, I wish I would lose weight like this. All right. So I'm just going to kind of cruise through a few of these PowerPoints because you've got them already, and it's generally the same point. So what do we want to get out of some of these functions? I do want to make sure that you understand the difference. We have people, and I kind of like try to throw bonus points on an exam. I don't call them really bonus points. So we don't give curves in here, but usually the exams have more than, let's say the first exam. How many points is the first exam worth? Anybody remember?
Nobody's looked at syllabus yet.
80, right? But you might have 85 points on that exam. The bonus points are built in, right? So we don't divide by 85, you know, for the average and stuff. If you get an 85, you got an 85. So you actually made better than 100%, right? So that's just how the exams go. But I try to throw in some teasers, like what is transcription? What is translation? Because as biologists, or taking a course at Bio 350, we should know these kind of things, right? And that can throw people off. you're a scientist in the sense you're going to get a degree, a college degree. We should know some of these basic concepts, and so try to refresh it. I'm not going to zap you with things that we haven't really covered. But transcription, right, from the DNA to messenger RNA, messenger RNA to proteins, translation, and then translation for that protein, and then that protein, we have a final protein. Is this protein that's made right here in translation, this protein always the final protein? What happens to some people that had cell? What happens with this protein if you looked at the protein structure, let's say the ion channel, and could you figure out the exact DNA sequence from that? What might be different? You got your amino acids of that protein, right? Proteins are made of amino acids, and then you backtrack, and you know which, you know, codons made that amino acid for that amino acid, but does it relate one-to-one? I think you were on it. Exactly. Post-translational modification, right? So this protein might be made, but in the ER, or it can be actually some parts cleaved out, change the conformation, right? So that protein sequence might not be exactly the same as it is that backtracking to the DNA because of post-translational modification. Why is this important? I know these tangents, but why is this important? Serotonin receptors. Right, serotonin, neuromodulator in your brain. You've probably heard of it, right? If anybody's on Prozac, I don't want to know it. But anyways, Prozac alters the serotonin levels. It's a mood modulator, right? There's lots of compounds that alter mood and maybe depression, which is a real disease and it's important. But serotonin works in altering the serotonin levels at a synapse. That's the idea. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, there's lots of drugs that bind to serotonin receptors. So you want to know how many serotonin receptors are in your brain, for example. And what's the binding affinity for that drug, right? And you can read sales rep stuff that's usually trash anyways because they don't give you enough information. They're trying to sell a product. So you want to know how many serotonin receptors are in your brain. And you want to know which drug binds to which receptor and how that receptor changes that neuronal behavior and might change your mood, for example. Get you out and going and doing things and get you out of a depressed state, for example. All right. So you can look up the sequence, that how many serotonin receptors you have, and you're going to say you have 14 serotonin receptors. 14 about, right? And there's different subgroups, but with the subgroups, about 14. But people have found out it's not just 14. If you look at, like, the messenger RNA, you get these 14 different subgroups, right? But when you start to look at the proteins of the serotonin receptors, you isolate the proteins, they found up to 54 different types of serotonin receptors in the human. 54 different types of serotonin receptors. But you only got 14 genes that you can find out for those in the messenger RNA. So what's the problem? Post-translational modifications. And so now you give somebody a drug that binds to this receptor and that efficiency, but they had a different post-translational modification. They have different family sequence, a little bit changing, right? Not exactly the same. Maybe that compound, that pharmacological compound, doesn't do the same kind of binding affinity and isn't going to have the same response, right? So this is why you have to really understand these concepts along with physiology, pull together that part. Serotonin, like Prozac, is supposed to, the idea is that it blocks the serotonin reuptake into the neuron. After it releases it, blocks the reuptake so it stays higher in the synaptic cleft. That's the take-home, supposedly, of this. But they found out that Prozac doesn't work the same in different people. They used to never talk about races, for example, because that was, you know, not, that was around, not supposed to talk about different races with different pharmacological agents, but now that's really important. Because they do know that some Asian populations, for example, that they've done, don't respond well to Prozac. And they found out that that serotonin transporter that's blocked by Prozac, they have a different type of transporter. It's post-translational modification. It's not really the genes so much, but it's modified differently, so Prozac doesn't work as well. So they have to go to a higher concentration. But now there's more side effects. It's really important to pay attention to all these kind of things. So it's really quite neat. To think about it, but it is important to look at the genetic breakdown as well as understand these different concepts. Okay, so we should know about the mitochondria. Do we all know about mitochondria? Are all the, you know, mitochondria has its own DNA, right? Can make its own proteins, right? Are all the proteins in a mitochondria made in a mitochondria? Where do some of the other proteins come from? From the cell that they're in, right? So this is a kind of like, whoa, what? I thought that was its own little self organelle. But some of those proteins come from the cell they're in and incorporate in the mitochondria to make the mitochondrial function, right? But the mitochondria does have its own DNA as well, right? So it can make some of its own proteins. So it's not in complete isolation from the cell. All right, so I just want you to remember some of these things. All right, so some of these processes that we're going to talk about, anaerobic, aerobic. Anaerobic means no oxygen, aerobic with oxygen, right? And we're going to talk about these pathways about making ATP. All right, so I'm going to go through these different pathways a little bit in general. And like we talked about last time, is I don't want you to memorize exactly the number of ATP, but a range. We should know a range of ATP that's made from the breakdown of glucose, right? About 32, some textbooks 34, some 36, depends on how they measured it. A lot of textbooks relate to FADH2 as 2 ATPs, NADH is as 3, but you see this one's around 2.5. Some of the differences come from the NADH made in glycolysis, the cytosol. To get that NADH into the mitochondria takes some energy too. So that's why it's not completely equal. So some of you that didn't have biochemistry, do not fret. You just know the general point. But the points that you have to remember for here is that in the cytosol, we have glycolysis. In the mitochondria, we have the other two reactions, the citric acid cycle and the electron transport chain. Most of your ATP is made in the electron transport chain, right? And we're going to go through that. So you see most of the ATP made down here, right? Electron transport chain. Glycolysis is not a very efficient system. Trick question. Not really a trick because you're going to know the answer. How many net ATP are made in glycolysis versus how many total ATP made in glycolysis? Is it the same?
Total is 4, but then the net is 2.
That's right. Total is 4, net is 2, because you use some ATP in glycolysis. Don't get confused on that. There's differences in net and total. And there's a little video on your webpage to watch, right? I know it seems a little corny, but watch that little video that's on your webpage. Click on that. It takes a little while to load, and then it has some little questions. You might see some of those questions again, okay? So I would go through that little animated video. All right, glycolysis, basically breaking down glucose to pyruvate in the cytoplasm of the cell, right? You have enzymes in there. It's not very efficient. We talked about a net 2 ATP. Now, the citric acid cycle, I've had people in the past say, I'm confused. I heard about the citric acid cycle. I heard about the Krebs cycle. I heard about the TCA cycle. I don't know which one's which. What's the answer?
They're all the same.
Hans Krebs is the guy that worked out the cycle. We call it the citric acid cycle because we start with citrate and go through. We call it the Krebs cycle because the Krebs, TCA, also the cycle. So they're all the same, but then we, you know, not to be confused about that, right? Okay, so acetyl-CoA, and then that goes on into the mitochondria, and then we go through electron transport chain, as we'll see here in a little bit, you know, from the breakdown of the acetyl-CoA with NADH and FADH2. So what do we have to remember? So it's a cycle. You can get the idea, cycle. And you see some of the key elements here, CO2, GTP is equal to an ATP. Don't get confused by that. Here we see where different FADH comes in. This is why you get a lower number of ATP produced from NADH. NADH comes in a different region, and you make more ATP from it. So that's why you get more ATP from NADH. We do not have to memorize the different processes in there, but some of the take-home messages, right? One glucose breaks down to how many acetyl-CoAs? 2, right? Because in glycolysis, you break that down, you get 2 pyruvates, and then 2 pyruvates go into this whole cycle. Okay, electron transport chain, that's where you make your most of your ATP. And what's the net reaction of glucose breakdown? Great tattoo. So you have a little butterfly in the middle of your back. You get this tattoo, right? CO2, 6 CO2s. Let's work it back. Or we can look at glucose. C6, H12, O6, plus 6 oxygens goes to 6 CO2s plus six waters, right? And that water is called metabolic water. You got it. There's your tattoo. Great tattoo, right? Go to the beach, you'll attract all the other nerds. All right. Okay, go to the great. And the electron transport chain in the mitochondria is fantastic in the way that it can pump hydrogen ion from this mitochondrial space into the inner mitochondrial space, and now you have that gradient. We're going to talk about gradients quite a bit in here when we get into the membrane physiology as well. That gradient of hydrogen ion that pumps over into the other side, because of that gradient, now you have high hydrogen ion in that inner mitochondrial space. It comes on through this cycle, and then in that little animation, it shows it kind of spinning around, and then it makes ADP, puts a phosphate on, you make the ATP. Okay, great. So now we have ATP in there, but it's due to that hydrogen ion concentration gradient. And that's really important to think about, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later. Then ATP, you made ATP. So what? What does that ATP down do? Why is that an energy molecule? If you had a bottle of ATP, it's going to explode. It's so full of energy. What does that ATP do for your body? Why is it an energy molecule? We covered it last Thursday, but you were shocked and traumatized and you forgot. ATP does what? Why is it an energy molecule? Okay, victims, 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 victims. Everybody's shy. Don't be shy. This is get your heart rate up. Malet? Kurodi?
It's
Malik. Yes, sorry.
How are you?
Good.
What was the question?
Why is ATP an energy molecule?
It's
full of energy. It's like a photon. No, joke. Lifeline. You can reach out for lifelines. Anybody want to get a lifeline? You want a lifeline?
Are ion channels relevant to this?
It could be, in a sense. But we're thinking of just the ATP itself. Everybody else put on your thinking hat. You might be the next victim. Do you want to reach out? Somebody with their hat.
I just say phosphate groups are able to break off the ATP.
And those phosphate groups go where? They break off. That gives the energy. That's part of the heat, for example, right? Because they're breaking the bond. So it's exothermic. It gives off heat. But those phosphate groups go and they do something to other proteins, possibly, called phosphorylation, right? And it could work on ion channels and cause a conformational change, and then you get some energy. Could work on an enzyme, turns on an enzyme, could turn it off, all different things. But it's a phosphate, and we asked a bunch of high school science teachers one time about what does ATP do for energy, and we had blanks on every one of them. So it's really kind of interesting to put this ATP in perspective. It's not just the energy itself, it's what it does. And it can phosphorylate other proteins, it can phosphorylate things, and if you break the ATP and a phosphate off and you get ADP plus phosphate, you get heat liberated, right? When you're shivering, right, and it's cold out there and you're shivering, you're speeding up your muscle contraction, you're using glucose up, you're breaking down, you're getting ATP, but you're not really doing work, right? You're not like walking, you're just shivering, right? But why is it raising your body temperature? Because you're breaking these bonds and it's making temperature rise. So think of your chemistry is important. So reactions, some things that you should remember, some gee whizzy stuff, right? Lactate and glycolysis. And lactate itself, that pH situation, you know, lactic acid buildup, right? And pH could drop. Lactate, we used to think about it wasn't used as an energy molecule, but now we know that even the brain can utilize lactate and actually convert it into and actually utilize it with some energy. It's interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But if we can use the aerobic metabolism and utilize oxygen, then we can get better, more efficient ATP out of the system. ATP group, right? Break off those phosphates. Why do we have this ATP energy? If we look at these values, I don't want you to memorize them, but I want you to get the idea. What's it? Remember from chemistry, delta G? What does delta G stand for? Gibbs free energy. If it's negative, what does it mean?
It's
spontaneous reaction does tell you how fast it works? Now, it could be a million years, right? It could be in seconds, milliseconds. But it tells you it's a favored reaction to break it down, basically, right? Gibbs free energy. Science, or science majors. Science, you've got to think about these. But ATP, you know, Gibbs free energy minus 7.3, we'll talk about a little bit later on. We talk about skeletal muscle. People load up with creatinine. You get that at health food stores. There's some legitimacy behind it because you can build up phosphocreatinine and you can get more energy. You can get some energy out of that too. As for use, and we'll talk about some other animals that store these other energy molecules and actually get energy from the system. Okay. So in general, this figure is kind of good because you just see it over and over again. We've talked about carbohydrates, glycolysis, right, in the cytoplasm, and then mitochondria, TCA, cycloelectron transport chain, right, ATP production. Can we get energy out of other storage molecules, for example, proteins, fat? I wish I could burn all of mine. But can we, why do we store fat? Why do we store fat? Horrible thing, right? Why do we store fat? For times when we might need that energy, right? But then we have to break it down. So in times of plenty, you eat food. If you're not breaking it all down, right, blowing off CO2, you can then storage that for when you need it. And so you store it. But it takes energy to put it into lipid form, right? It takes energy to build the lipids and storage it. So that's taking energy because you have surplus. But when you need it, then you can break it down. It doesn't go through glycolysis. It goes through a fatty acid cycle we'll talk about. But it can enter in here, and then you can get energy out of it. So animals can store fat, can get energy out of that, right? And it's a good reserve to store that fat to break down because it doesn't take water along with it like glucose would, right? So now you can decrease your body weight by not having to store water with that energy molecule, because you can put it into fat instead. So we'll talk more about that. Proteins, when you're really deprived of your fat stores, your glycogen stores, what are you going to start breaking down? Muscle, right? And you're going to start breaking down muscle to get amino acids. And those amino acids can enter into the TCA cycle at different spots, like glutamate, alanine. Things can add in at different spots, and you can get them energy out of breaking down your proteins to amino acids and then get energy out of that. So that's a big problem. How do you regulate this process? How can we just eat a meal and we just don't make all the ATP at once? And then 10 minutes later, we're like, got to eat again, right? How do you regulate this? How do you keep your energy stores up in the glycogen or not break down all the glucose at once in the cell? By the enzyme regulation, right? We just talked about all these cascades, but how do you regulate these enzymes? So just in the TCA cycle itself, you can see inhibited, so this is a citric acid cycle, TCA, Krebs cycle, you can see here inhibited by ATP. So if you have too much ATP, you inhibit that enzyme. This one's actually stimulated by ADP, right, after you break down ATP. So stimulated by it, so it can promote it. This one inhibited by succinyl-CoA and NADH. So if you have too much of that around, it inhibits this from working. You have some other spots in here that can stimulate. The take-home here is not to memorize where. The idea is that there's feedback regulation on the biochemical steps, not to break it all down at once. Break it down as you need it. So pretty neat, right? And the same thing can happen in the electron transport chain. There's various blockers, but some of these are bad blockers. Some drugs, like antibiotics, can block the electron transport chain. This is an issue. Some of them, like cyanide, if you ever have cyanide, don't attempt it. And azides, and what's this? Carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide, not good, right? And the exhaust of the gas, right? Don't start your car in the garage and warm it up. That's really bad. But carbon monoxide is really bad because it blocks the electron transport chain. Then you can't make ATP. And why do you die from that if you can't make ATP? What's the reason you're going to die? I know we're ending on a bad note. Carbon monoxide, not making ATP. What do we need ATP for? Make phosphorylation muscle contraction. What muscle are we thinking about?
Heart.
Heart and?
Diaphragm,
right? Diaphragm. Get the air going in and out to keep the CO2 going out. right? So you can contribute to the global CO2 in the atmosphere, right?
Full circle.
All right, so we're going to work on the next PowerPoint later on.
Like for most of it. How does that have to do with diabetic ketoacidosis?
Oh, that's definitely the same situation.
Yeah.
So you have ketones. If you're breaking down, like in diabetics, right?
Yeah.
They have too much glucose and they're can't get it maybe all in the cells, and you're breaking down fats, even or the ketogenic diet, for example. Same thing, right? The byproduct, acetoacetate, is made, and that's one of the ketones that is the problem. And that ketones are your those byproducts, they relate to acidosis.
Yeah.
Ketoacidosis means your ketones are high and your pH is low together. Versus just acidosis from not breathing.
You don't have
the
ketones.
Yeah, it's not the ketones. So the ketone acidosis is two together. You're acidotic, but you also have ketones, the fruity breath kind of thing. Acidosis, you can just hold your breath. Acidotic.
Gotcha. Okay. Good to know.
That help?
Yes.
And we'll cover that when we get into the endocrine system when we talk about glucose regulation.
Yeah, I heard it. My boyfriend's a type 1 diabetic, and he went into DK twice this past year. So
that's hard. So hopefully he regulates it. Quite carefully.
Yeah, he's like very good. Yeah.
And, people eat high fats for the ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
That's a problem, too. They have to watch carefully about that.
And that's just like the keto diet, is that?
Yes, it's the same thing.
Yeah, my friend's doing that.
But some of it is, there's all different forms of this.
Yeah, he's doing